Hello, I'm Adrian Rodriguez. This is number 0438, the Stealth File Program, with your host, Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stealth File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0438. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet IndyCar drivers Alex Rossi and Connor Daly, who are currently a team on The Amazing Race. By the way, they're also roommates.
Connor and I have known each other for 7 years now, and we raced together in Europe. We've always been kind of on the same path. I mean, we kind of know each other's personalities really well, and obviously you mentioned we live together. So I think going on this show where you're kind of put with someone for an extended period of time and you really have to work closely together was something that was fairly easy for us to kind of, you know, get to that point of working well together quickly, and you know, I think it was an advantage we had on other teams.
Karen Page is the author of the cookbook, Kitchen Creativity. It's all about being creative.
You can just imagine how the first people who started cooking, gathering ingredients, putting them together, that whole long historical process of evolution, of discovery of flavor affinities, what goes together, what doesn't go together. And you can just envision somebody throwing together something crazy like scallops and blueberries and realizing and rosemary and thinking, well, that's hideous. Let's throw that out. Let's never do that again. And then you throw together a combination like tomatoes and mozzarella and basil. It's like, oh my God, that's amazing. What can we put it on next?
Aaron David Roberts is the creator, producer, director of the web series The Castmates. It deals with people who work in a movie theater, something Aaron knows a little bit about.
I spent some time right out of high school, actually my first job, working at a movie theater as an usher, concessions, you know, doing that whole thing. So a lot of what we have, not just in the pilot, but set up for future episodes of the show is pretty much, you know, ripped straight from real life and real experiences between myself working at the theater.
And we have lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0438 was Adrian Rodriguez, who is an amazing photographer. As someone who takes quite a few pictures myself, Adrian is the photographer I want to be when I grow up. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, by the way, and see a link to some of his great work. And thank you very much, Adrian, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And I've recently uploaded several celebrity interviews from the past that I did on the radio show, on both this show, the Stuff File program, and my old radio show. They're up there on Patreon as well, and I will be adding a lot more. So go there, check them out, sign up, check them out, and be part of the Patreon experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? I trust when all was tallied up during your Christmas holiday that you got everything you wanted on your list. Imagine what it's like when an entire street gets what they want for Christmas. That's what happened in England. Everyone on the street is delighted, said an unidentified woman in Maidstone and Snodland in southern England. We are planning to have an estate party to celebrate them being locked up. Their delight is from an entire family on their street being imprisoned just in time for Christmas. The father of the family is long dead, but 54-year-old mom Leslie Selwood and her son Lee, who is 31, are behind bars for several months for a fray. That's a fancy word for an instance of fighting in a public place that disturbs the peace. Now, son Jason Selwood, who is 33, was imprisoned for 6 years for trying to blow up an ATM to get the cash inside. Darren Selwood, who is 34, is behind bars for 15 months after stabbing a friend who had the temerity to ask for some of his steak dinner. After 17 previous convictions for various offenses, such as stomping on a man's head and leaving him brain damaged, Daughter Kelly, who is 29, recently got out after squirting toilet cleaner on a neighbor who complained about her loud music. They need to be cut some slack, Leslie whined, because it's Christmas. No, they are feral scumbags, scum of the earth, the boy's aunt retorted. I am delighted to see they are behind bars. Merry Christmas to them all. Wow. Family and neighbors seem confident the Selwoods don't read the newspaper or search online or don't hold a grudge when they get out, because I kind of get the feeling that grudges are this family's specialty. Okay. In the dawn of a new year, it is common for new laws to kick in. With the many challenges facing the United States, what sort of laws are coming to address them? Well, North Carolina is adding instructions to its driver's handbook to tell motorists what to do when stopped by police to reduce the chances the cops will kill them. In Illinois, the new state grain is declared to be corn. We're all waiting for that. Barbers in Tennessee will be allowed to make house calls if they get a residential certificate first. And in California, you can no longer get a ticket for jaywalking. As long as you succeed in crossing safely, you win. Okay, so wait a minute. What if you don't cross safely? Do your heirs get a ticket? Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Florida authorities are sharing the details of an unusual 911 call on New Year's Eve from a Michael Lester who said he wanted to report a drunk driver. Himself. Now, I don't really need to read this story to you. There's 911 audio goodness to share all the details. This is a bit of a long call, so buckle up and enjoy.
911, what's the address of your emergency?
All over Winterhaven.
What's the address of your emergency right now? Sir? Hello?
I don't know. She's drunk. I don't know where I'm at.
Okay, what is it you're trying to report, sir?
I was just drunk driving.
You're drunk driving right now?
Yeah, all night.
Okay, well, can you
I'm
pull
actually right in front of the police department right now.
Okay, can you pull over somewhere so an officer...
But they won't.
Where are you right now?
I don't know. I'm too drunk.
Okay, well, you need to pull over. Can you pull over for me? Can you pull over for me so we're going to get an officer to make contact with you? I'm showing that you're near 142nd Street Northwest. Can you look around and see for a sign? What color is your
vehicle? Yeah, it's right past the police department, but no one's there, so...
Sir, what color is your...
Crazy.
Sir, what color is your vehicle?
It is red.
What kind is it?
Oh, it's F-150.
Okay, and where have you pulled? Where have you pulled over to?
I don't know what street this is here, but it's right past the police station, Winterhaven. Let me ask you a question.
Okay, well, sir, I have officers on. No, this is Polk County Sheriff's Office. We dispatch for Winterhaven, and we have a unit coming out to you now. What is your last name? Your last name, sir?
I think I'm going to go get something to eat. They can catch up with me.
No, sir. What is your last name?
Is it helpful?
Yeah, it's very helpful. Yes, sir, it is. Where have you been all night?
Driving around, trying to get pulled over, actually.
Sir, what is your last name?
No. I don't feel like giving that to you right now.
Okay, you called because you wanted assistance. Are you driving now or did you pull over?
No, I pulled over.
Okay, what are you next to? Can you look out there and see what you're near? A landmark? What do you see?
It's,
what do you...
Like, Silver Manor. I'm probably in Fulton here.
Do you need EMS or paramedics?
No, I need the police department.
Okay, well, that's what I'm trying to get to you. So, if you do me a favor, look out. What do you see? Do you see a McDonald's? Do you see a bank? What do you see?
It's a, Publix.
You're near Publix? Are you in the parking lot?
No, I'm driving on the wrong side of the road.
Now you're driving on the wrong side of the road, going in which direction?
Oh, no, this guy won't get on the way, though.
Sir, where are you? You really don't want to hurt
you. Have a nice night.
Sir.
Hi.
Sir.
Have a good night.
Sir. Officers are looking for you right now. I need you to pull over right now.
I am pulled over. You don't need to tell me what to do.
Sir, you called for help. I'm trying to help you. And you're on the wrong side of the street. You may hurt somebody or yourself.
Look, I'm parking in the middle of the road. This
no, I don't want you parking in the middle of the road. I want you to pull into a lot.
You know what? You don't have to. So either they're going to do it or not.
They're going to... Sir, they're going to do what or not?
I'll have to let you go. I've got to talk to the police officers.
Thank you. Sir.
You're not getting any more information from me. Have a good night.
Wow. Deputies said Lester admitted drinking beers and swallowing methamphetamine. He also said he barely slept for several days. The sheriff's office Facebook page says Lester's criminal history includes DUI, aggravated battery, drug possession, and hit and run. Well, it sounds like he's learned from his hit and run past, at least. This time he just sat there and waited for the cops before he hit anything. He's slowly working his way up the evolutionary curve, it seems to be. Now, let's leave somebody behind who should never be on the road and talk to two guys who should be on the road. The 30th season of CBS's The Amazing Race is now on the air, and one of the teams involved on the show already knows what racing is all about. Alexander Rossi and Connor Daly are not only roommates who are competing on the show, they are also world-class IndyCar drivers. Alex won the 100th running of the Indianapolis 500 in 2016, being the first rookie to win that race since 2001. Connor has racing in his DNA, being the son of retired Formula One and IndyCar driver Derek Daly, and has won races in nearly every form of racing in which he has competed. Alex and Connor join us on the line via Skype from Los Angeles. Hi, guys.
How are you?
Hey, man. How you doing?
Great. Thanks for being on the program with us. At the time of this taping, one of the episodes has aired, so we know a little bit as to how your chemistry works together on the show. As I mentioned, you guys are also roommates, so how was that played into working together on The Amazing Race? Did that help or hurt you?
Well, I think it was a positive thing. I mean, Connor and I have known each other for 7 years now, and we raced together in Europe. You know, we've always been kind of on the same path, and we kind of know each other's personalities really well. And obviously, you mentioned we live together, so I think going on this show where you're kind of put with someone for an extended period of time and you really have to work closely together was something that was fairly easy for us to kind of get to that point of working well together quickly. And I think it was an advantage we had on other teams.
How was the decision made for you guys to even apply to be on the show? Was one of you more interested in doing it and had to convince the other, or did you reach a mutual agreement and say, yeah, let's do this?
I think I was certainly a fan of the show, and when IndyCar presented the opportunity, I mean, for sure it was something that we wanted to do because it's, you know, a big exposure for us, for our fans, for our sport, and, you know, we obviously hope to gain new fans as well, fans of the show, hopefully they can be fans of IndyCar as well and fans of us, so I think it was a pretty easy decision for us.
Now, you guys, as I mentioned in the introduction, you're well-renowned IndyCar drivers. There are other people, other teams on this particular season of The Amazing Race that have some pretty well-known accomplishments. But that being said, did you feel any kind of intimidation factor on your part having to deal with some of the other teams, or did you feel there might be a target on your back because of your successes?
I think that there was a huge amount of mutual respect among all of the teams right from the very beginning. You could tell just by the way people carry themselves and, you know, just their physical appearance and everything, that they were serious teams. I mean, there was no old teams. There was no kind of like teams that didn't look that impressive. So, you know, once we got to understand what everyone's backgrounds were, we realized that they were all professionals of their trade or their sport, and they were all, you know, the upper echelon. So we knew that it was going to be competitive. Phil and the producers said it was the most competitive cast that they've ever had, and I think that was definitely the case.
But in terms of intimidation, I mean, we deal with, you know, competition on a weekly basis. So it was nothing that we were concerned about. But there was definitely a healthy respect for all of the teams. And actually, coming out of it, we became friends with I'd say, most of them, which was a pretty cool thing.
You talk about becoming friends. It's one of the things I've always enjoyed about The Amazing Race, and I've seen every episode in all the 30 or the 29 previous seasons, and that is, even when teams are eventually eliminated at the end, it's one of the only, and I hate to really call it a reality show, it's more like a game show or a competition. It's the only competition I've ever seen where people seem pretty happy about the idea of what they've experienced, even at the point of when they're being eliminated. So that's one of the things I've always found to be a positive factor on this show. It's not as mean-spirited as a lot of the other shows can be. Now, in watching the show, a lot of people often sit down and say, gee, I wonder if I could do that. I wonder how trying and how difficult or how grueling those situations might be. Now that you've actually done it and haven't been fans for years of watching it, would you say it's a lot harder than it looks?
I think that's easy to say, yeah. I mean, it's just something that just people don't understand. I mean, it's you know, stuff that you're so not used to doing in your day-to-day life. You know, you might get lucky with one activity that somehow you might recognize, or it might be a sport that you might be affiliated with, but really it's just tough for everyone. And that's something I think we were pretty decent at is adapting to new things and getting used to kind of all the different activities that we had to do, because, you know, I think our sport is underrated when it comes to physicality and mental preparation. So I think, you know, we were able to get used to the difficult challenges that might have been new for us better than most.
I know you can't go into details as to how you guys did, because of course the show is ongoing on the air right now, and you can't talk about what has not happened yet on screen, but you guys live in a world that one could say you are adrenaline junkies because you're auto racers. Was there anything you did on The Amazing Race that scared you? And again, you don't have to go into details, but played into personal fears that either one of you had.
Unfortunately, no. I mean, I don't think there was. I mean, as you mentioned, we're obviously very used to the concept of being involved in a very dangerous activity. You know, to a certain extent, we know that we're taking a risk with our lives kind of on a weekly basis. So there wasn't anything that was scary per se. I think the biggest fear that we had was failing in challenges or the unknown of what was coming up. And it's because we're such competitive people. I mean, we want to win everything that we do, and that's what drives us and motivates us to wake up each morning. So the fear of not executing something, I think, was the biggest thing versus an actual challenge that we were scared of, if you will.
So neither one of you has either a fear of heights or a fear of water or a fear of eating strange foods or any of the things we've seen come up over the years on that show?
Well, I mean, I have certain fears, but I don't think there were many that came up. I don't know. One of those things that just, I don't know. I mean, I certainly didn't encounter many, many fears. So I guess I was lucky.
Now, again, we've only seen one episode since it started to air last week. And of course, you experienced what was going on in that show. Having now watched a show, does it change your perspective? Because you know what went on, you know how long things took, you know how long the travel was. Does the editing experience change the experience you have in watching the show?
I think the only thing was, you know, there was a lot more footage than the actual airtime that we got. So that is the only thing that was different. I don't think that, you know, we were edited any differently than we remember. I just feel like, you know, there was so much time that went into the actual filming of it, and it's a little bit disappointing to only be on camera for maybe 55 seconds to 60 seconds for the whole episode. Mm.
Now, a lot's been said. You guys are popular on social media to begin with, but a lot's been said of the fact that Connor, you live in Alex's house. You're on his couch. If you guys win, you know, Alex would like his couch back, and you want to move out.
Just for some clarification, that was more Phil's joke. Connor does live with me, but he definitely is not on a couch. So
okay,
it's been a cool experience to have him. I'm around for sure. So it was more of a funny thing than an actual reality.
Yeah. Now, Alex, I actually saw you. I think you did a Harry Connick Jr. show. Did you not?
Yes, I did. Yep.
So that was your first taste of a sort of reality competition, was it?
Well, not really. I mean, that's just a talk show, no?
Yeah. But I mean, you had a little bit of didn't you do a little competition with each other on that show?
Well, yeah, I guess we drove remote control cars around the track, but yeah, it wasn't. I wouldn't say it's too comparable to Amazing Race.
I understand you watched the show in a viewing party.
Yep.
What are the people, your friends and family? What are the people? What are they saying about what they've seen so far?
Well, honestly, the episode was so short. I think we were on screen for like maybe 45 seconds, so I there's not a lot to tell yet. Hopefully the family will be able to see more. If we make it further. So hopefully. You know, people will get a better idea of what goes on later on in the show.
How does the discipline of being a race car driver, how does that help or does that hinder you in doing chores or doing challenges in something like the Amazing Race?
I think it only helps us. I mean, we've got a very diverse skill set that people always discredit and probably never give us, a fair chance to display. I mean, our sport is one of the most physically difficult, mentally demanding sports in the world. I think that gives us a leg up, and it certainly probably made us an underdog in a lot of teams' minds because they just don't understand what we do. So that's kind of, I think it was a good thing.
I know that while you guys drive the vehicles yourselves, IndyCar, like any race car, is really a collaborative team. It's a lot of people pulling together with the goal to making you guys winners on the track. In the Amazing Race, it's just a team of two. Does that magnify the situation with just the two of you pitted against others?
Not really. I mean, I guess you're very right in the sense that motorsports is a team sport, and there's a whole lot that goes into being successful on the racetrack. But at the same time, you know, you are still the one on the racetrack making the decisions, and you ultimately pay the consequences if you make the wrong decision. So, you know, it was good to be able to work with Connor and bounce ideas off each other. But at the same time, I mean, we're both very used to being independent and making decisions for ourselves.
Win, lose, or draw in the Amazing Race, how do you feel the publicity of this will help you guys going forward when it comes to IndyCar?
I certainly think it'll help us quite a lot. You know, certainly for Alex, you know, and hopefully for me, you know, I'm in a situation where I need to get back into a racing car. I was let go as soon as I got back from filming the show. So it was difficult to take that. So hopefully this show can, provide new opportunities for me and then obviously just build both of our profiles.
Well, continued success. We look forward to watching the two of you guys on the show on The Amazing Race in the weeks to come. Hopefully, you'll make it all the way till the final three and beyond. I thank you for taking the time to chat with us. By the way, I can hear a lot of cars in the background. Where are you right now?
We're just in L.A. We're on our way to another activity, so we've got to be moving.
IndyCar drivers Alex Rossi and Connor Daly, who together make up one of the teams on the 30th season of The Amazing Race. You can find this season of The Amazing Race now playing on CBS and also in Canada on CTV. Check your local listings. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about kitchen creativity. Plus, we'll also meet the creator, producer, and director of the cast members. And we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. And much more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com and help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, a Forks, Washington Police Department officer pulled over a car belonging to a woman with an outstanding warrant. But when the officer approached, he saw Dennis Fisher in the driver's seat, a small child in a car seat calling for its mommy, but no woman. The officer noticed one of the back seats was partially folded forward and told Fisher he thought the mother was in the trunk. He gave Fisher the option of opening the trunk or waiting there for a search warrant. "Fine," Fisher said, "I'll get her out." The woman in the trunk replied, "Let me out." Once the woman was arrested, she arranged for someone to pick up the baby, but as she hugged her child, she noticed something in the diaper. "What's in the diaper?" she asked. "Poop," Fisher replied. The woman changed the baby, and the officer noticed a plastic bag inside, allegedly containing a golf ball-sized quantity of meth. Fisher was arrested, but was released after denying knowledge that the meth was in the diaper or the 13 loaded syringes in the car. Later, though, he was caught in a sting and was charged with distribution of heroin and methamphetamine, along with other related charges. Wow. That story has not one, but two cases of junk in the trunk, doesn't it? Yeah. Meanwhile, a train was moving slowly through New Jersey when a worker on board spotted something on a Patterson Bridge. A man with his pants down, reportedly making a solid contribution to the Passaic River. The worker tried to prevent the train from hitting the apparent defecator, but the man ended up being retrieved screaming from the icy river by emergency personnel who brought him to a hospital. A New York, Susquehanna, and Western Railway representative said the train struck someone, but police reports left open the possibility that the man chose to jump rather than be hit by the train. Wow. When you've got to go, you've got to go. I guess if we were looking for a headline for the story, it would have to be called Potty Train. Yeah, I know, I said it. Anyway, we have one more story before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. According to investigators, 35-year-old Danny Hollis Jr. broke into a Nashville, Tennessee home and terrorized the family there. "This man walks in," recounted Lieutenant Melinda Brewer. "The family is all in there, minding their own business. The man isn't wearing a stitch of clothing and says the dog is looking at him. He grabs a knife and cuts his throat. He then goes upstairs and jumps out of a window after busting his head on the glass of the front door, and then he takes off running. Hollis jumped onto a gazebo in the backyard and ran across a field where deputies were able to catch up with him and arrested him after he smacked his head on the pavement. Hollis allegedly admitted he was smoking WASP, a mixture of meth and crystallized bug spray that Brewer says is worse than bath salts, causing psychotic episodes. Hollis said he couldn't remember anything he did. Wow. A few more doses, and he won't have to remember his years behind bars either. Seriously, meth and bug spray? It has to be a psychotic mind that comes up with ideas like this in the first place. Yikes! That's a recipe for disaster. And speaking of recipes, boy, there's a bad segue. But anyway, speaking of recipes, Karen Page is one of the most influential and important food writers out there today. She has written award-winning culinary classics. Her latest book is Kitchen Creativity, Unlocking Culinary Genius with Wisdom, Inspiration, and Ideas from the World's Most Creative Chefs. The book is filled with secrets and strategies from more than 100 leading culinary minds. And Karen joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, Karen.
Hello, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thank you very much for being on the program with us.
I love that.
Full disclosure, I am a kitchen Luddite. You probably are not going to meet a pickier eater than me. But I understand the popularity and the need for cookbooks. I have a few of them myself, and cookbooks are so popular. But the thing I find interesting about this one is it also talks about the intuitive approach to cooking, i.e., without recipes. It seems like it's a situation that goes back to that harkens back to a different time, when that's how most people would cook.
Exactly. And that's really, I mean, if you can just imagine how the first people who started cooking, gathering ingredients, putting them together, that whole long historical process of evolution, of discovery of flavor affinities, what goes together, what doesn't go together. And you can just envision somebody throwing together something crazy like scallops and blueberries and realizing, and rosemary, and thinking, well, that's hideous. Let's throw that out. Let's never do that again. And then you throw together a combination like tomatoes and mozzarella and basil. It's like, oh my God, that's amazing. What can we put it on next? Let's do it as a pizza. Let's do it as a panini. Let's do it as a pasta. Let's make a cocktail out of it. And I think that's really the creative process of really kind of the evolution of figuring out what works together, what doesn't, and how can you apply that in to move cuisine forward in all different ways.
I think back to my mother, who was a pretty good cook in her own right, and some of the things that she would do. And I remember as a kid trying to get some of her delicacies that I wanted to try my hand at, and I would say, well, Mom, how do you make this or how do you make that? And she would always go, I don't know. It was so frustrating.
Right, because a lot of times, unless you're doing baking, which tends to be very scientific, it is chemistry, so you want to work with specific recipes and specific quantities of ingredients. But other than that, a lot of times cooking got its start is much more intuitive, because that's all people had to work with, was their common sense and their imaginations. And we're trying to move people away from that over-reliance on recipes, that you know, if I don't have every ingredient that's called for in a recipe, including a 16th of a teaspoon of X, then I'm not going to be able to make the recipe. Well, I think if you learn to cook more intuitively, you understand the principles that are at work with any recipe, and you can say, oh, I'm not just adding vinegar, I'm adding acidity. So I might be out of vinegar, but I've got lemon juice. I bet that would work. And so you can learn to tweak recipes, make substitutions with much more confidence, because you're figuring out what the principles are at work in any individual dish that you're trying to move forward with. So instead, if you run out of salt, God forbid, since that's such an important ingredient for adding flavor to most savory dishes, if you've got some leftover feta cheese in the refrigerator, there's a little liquid off to the side that's keeping it moist, you can pour some of that feta liquid in and use that as a salt substitute. And in fact, in some cases, you might even want to do that proactively if you're coming up with, say, a Greek salad where there's going to be the same or similar flavors in there anyway. Why not just add something like that, which is going to be a compatible flavor that will take the salad to a whole new level?
At what level of cooking does someone need to be to have kitchen creativity? And the reason why I ask that, I'll use an analogy from radio. I know when I first started in radio, I broke a few rules, and my boss was telling me that he was okay with me breaking a few rules because he said you had to know the rules first in order to break them.
Exactly. So, I think that's that Picasso's saying as well. And I think where kitchen creativity comes into play is not just with the world's most creative chefs, who tend to be huge fans of our prior best-selling book, The Flavor Bible, and What to Drink with What You Eat. But with kitchen creativity, it can be open the minds of any reader, anyone who goes into the kitchen, even casually, and wants to understand the principles that the leading chefs use to become more creative cooks. And we break everything down into a three-stage process of mastery, alchemy, and creativity. So it will give you all the building blocks you need to work your way up to creativity if you're not quite there yet yourself.
Do you have to think about that when you're in the process of writing a book, thinking about how not to, on the one hand, scare off the novice who might want to try something new, and on the other hand, not talk down to somebody who thinks themselves to be a kitchen genius?
That is a great question. And I think it's a little bit of an art and not a science, because you want to appeal and be helpful to the greatest number of home cooks, because we're all human. We all eat on an average 3 times a day. And even those of us who are culinary Luddites like yourself, you know, still want to be able to, you know, we don't want to starve to death. We want to be able to throw together, whether it's pasta in a quick sauce or something that's easy to make to keep ourselves fed, but also to keep ourselves entertained and interested, because food is so much more than sustenance. It should be nutritious, but it should especially be delicious, because it's something that brings so much sensory pleasure to our lives. And so I think kitchen creativity can find a place in the kitchen, not just of the country's best chefs as it is currently, but really anyone who loves food and wants to become a better cook.
As someone who has put out so many cookbooks, so many successful cookbooks, how do you go about, when you're creating a new one like this one, Kitchen Creativity, how do you go about trying to do something, well, quite frankly, that you haven't done before, something that is different, something that stands out from not only your own cookbooks, but others that might be out there?
Well, we always start with the burning questions that we want to know the answers to. And so each book, from Becoming a Chef to Culinary Artistry to Dining Out and on through the others, has led to the next book. There's a whole set of questions that's left for us. And as we follow that evolutionary thread, it's really by necessity led us into whole different directions. And where kitchen creativity has led us is really into understanding from chefs' perspectives their exploration not only of the outer senses, to how they develop their great senses of taste, their great senses of smell, and so forth, but also how they develop their inner senses of developing their culinary instincts and intuition, insight, imagination, and inspiration. And that's really where the creativity comes into play. And those are lessons that you can apply to enhance your creativity anywhere, whether in the boardroom of a Fortune 500 company or in your kitchen on a Tuesday night. So it's really something that really understanding the world's greatest minds and some of the most creative culinary professionals in the world today happen to be chefs and culinary artists, through getting inside their heads and understanding how their thought process works and how they've achieved the great innovations that they have, and working to spell it out for everyone. That's really led us to coming up with the next book and the next book.
Has cooking changed in the ways that people treat it? And the reason why I say that, I grew up in a time, and I'm a late baby boomer, I grew up in a time when most women were home, they were the homemakers, and they were always home, and it seems that they were always cooking. And my mom didn't necessarily think of herself as a great cook, because it's something she kind of took for granted. She did it every day. Flash forward to today, where people are leading busy lives, both men and women, and people don't necessarily have the time to cook. And they look at it as something almost daunting, and that it's something that they couldn't do, when you look back at it, it's something that our parents or grandparents did naturally and kind of took for granted.
Exactly. And there have been a lot of societal dynamics that have changed dramatically in recent decades, where women have reentered the workforce in greater numbers in the 60s and the 70s especially. And that led to moving away from, you know, the standard idea of mom or grandma in the kitchen cooking for their families, to the idea of chefs becoming the new moms, so to speak, where we look to chefs for delight and for comfort and for nurturing. And that, I think, has been one of the issues that has driven the whole chefs as celebrity craze, where we look to the people who cook for us and who have created these memories for us. And more often than not these days, with more meals being eaten outside the home than at home, as of the 1990s, we're looking to chefs for that sense of comfort. And so it's interesting that the younger generation, sort of that Gen X, who some of whom were latchkey kids who would come home and pour themselves, you know, cereal with milk, a lot of times the new pastry chefs today are using cereal milk as a flavor of pies, of ice cream, of other creations that they're coming up with. Christina Tosi, who used to be the pastry chef of Momofuku and who won the James Beard Award for Outstanding Pastry Chef, she is a chef that has really put forward those flavors. And once I understood that cereal milk was such a comfort flavor to millennials, kind of the way that for our generation it was maybe more mac and cheese or mashed potatoes or a nice soup, you know, that they've got these commercial foods that are branded items that they have this sense of nostalgia for, because that was what nurtured them when both their parents were off at work and they would be at home alone pouring a bowl of cereal for themselves. So that's an interesting dynamic to understand.
It sounds like the key to starting someone's creativity in the kitchen is to start with something that, to whatever generation they were from, was a comfort food to them.
Well, it's certainly one way to start. I think the underlying principle behind that is really it gets down to love. It's like, what do you love? What represents love to you? And that's really what we mean by comfort foods, is the kind of foods that we eat that give ourselves a warm, fuzzy feeling of being nurtured and taken care of. And if you can unlock that for anyone you're cooking for, whether it's your husband or wife or someone you want to be a loved one, then that can take you a long way. If you understand what are their trigger foods, trigger ingredients, strawberries might be something that lights up their eyes, or chocolate. What can you do with that to really please them? And the more you can understand about the person you're cooking for, or the people you're cooking for, the more you can please them and the more creative a meal you can create for them.
The book is called Kitchen Creativity, Unlocking Culinary Genius with Wisdom, Inspiration, and Ideas from the World's Most Creative Chefs. Karen, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with me.
Oh, such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Karen Page, author of Kitchen Creativity, Unlocking Culinary Genius with Wisdom, Inspiration, and Ideas from the World's Most Creative Chefs. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0438, and you'll find links to Karen's website, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Wouldn't it be nice if there was a simple way to get rid of all the frivolous lawsuits we hear about in the news? For example, when a blind man is walking through a mall with the help of his seeing-eye dog and accidentally steps on a woman's foot and then is sued by that woman, and yes, that's a real lawsuit, shouldn't there be an easy way for a judge to throw that case out? Believe it or not, there is a way. The lawyer representing a victim of a frivolous lawsuit simply has to ask the judge to dismiss it. Whether the judge does that is another matter, but the point is, judges must be asked first. Let's be fair, you'd think every lawyer who's hired to defend someone from a frivolous lawsuit would do that, but not so. Several judges have told me over the years that too many lawyers simply don't ask them to dismiss frivolous lawsuits. Now, I don't want to step on anyone's toes here, but if someone ever files a frivolous case against you, make sure your lawyer's first move is to have that case dismissed. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's now gluten-free.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the creator of the web series, the cast members. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. And one more Stuff File news story that I want to share with you here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make the show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, police in Maryland said a wild fraternity party included so much alcohol consumption that the air inside the house registered a positive on a breathalyzer. Montgomery County Police said that they were called to a rental home in Bethesda by neighbors who complained about a party at a residence where six 20-year-old members of fraternity Sigma Alpha Epsilon's American University chapter reside. Police said there was so much booze at the party that the air inside the house registered a 0.01 on a breathalyzer. Police said the six residents who refused to tell officers where they obtained the alcohol for the party were each charged with 126 counts of allowing underage possession of alcohol and furnishing alcohol to a minor. They could each face up to $315,000 in fines, that's each, stemming from the charges. Wow. Just how much beer did they have? I mean, their total fine could come to $1.89 million. There are many microbreweries that in a year don't earn that much. Wow. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Aaron David Roberts is the driving force behind the cast members, the web series that he created, self-produced, and directed. The show centers around Ryan Wyatt, a budding filmmaker who is working as an usher at Royal Cinemas, that's the town's social hub, in a San Diego suburb. Aaron joins us on the line right now from San Diego to talk about the journey that he has taken with his pet project. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, how's it going, Peter? How you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. As I mentioned in the introduction, the show centers around a guy who works as a theater usher. And for 6 years as a teenager myself, I worked as a theater usher and a projectionist. So this really hit close to home for me.
Yeah, well, I mean, it should. I spent some time right out of high school, actually, my first job, working at a movie theater as an usher, concessions, you know, doing that whole thing. So a lot of what we have, not just in the pilot, but set up for future episodes of the show, is pretty much, you know, ripped straight from real life and real experiences between myself working at the theater.
Have any of the people who you worked with through those years, have they seen your pilot, or are they aware of what you're doing, the story that you're creating, basically from a time period in your own life?
Yeah, actually, you know, we have almost 300,000 views now on the pilot on Facebook, and, you know, I definitely had a couple people who used to work with me reach out or comment on the post, hey, you know, I recognize a few of these characters, or, you know, that type of thing. You know, so that's really been cool, and also just seeing movie theater workers from all over the country, even all over the world. We have fans in Australia, fans in Britain, who, you know, can just identify because they also work the same job, and it's kind of the same whether you're in America or, you know, Canada or wherever you're at.
Now, as I mentioned, you created, self-produced, and directed this. I guess it was your plan, correct me if I'm wrong, that you wanted to get this on television, but you started as a web series, and you're growing it from there. Tell us a little bit about the business model and the journey you've taken to getting this in front of eyeballs, both the people who will watch it and perhaps those who will co-produce it and help you with it on a network level.
Yeah, you know, it's actually been quite the journey. You know, I had the concept for this TV show back in 2014. You know, that was kind of the first thing I started working on out of high school, and I always will say that this show was kind of my version of film school. And, you know, we shot a couple different versions of it, and then I took out a personal loan, actually, to kind of get the version that you see today done. You know, and then a couple of my producing partners and friends from high school helped me produce it, and we made the whole thing on a budget of about $4,500. And, you know, kind of the business model of a web series is just prove you have an audience. Just try to grow. You know, we started from scratch. We started from nothing. We started from a Facebook page with, you know, zero followers, and now we have over 3,200 people, you know, who follow our page. And like I said, we've had almost 300,000 views. And the idea is to just be undeniable and show people that there's a market for the show, show people that there's an audience who wants to see more episodes, and then, you know, hopefully it gets in front of some of the right eyes and, you know, maybe Netflix or ABC or, you know, whoever. You never know who's going to come calling, right?
Now, as you say, you never know who's coming to call, who's going to come calling, but do you have a preference? Because, you know, there's a whole different world when you just talk about two of the entities you mentioned, being on traditional network television with commercials like ABC and having to deal with standards and practices, for instance, and being on something like Netflix where you would have more control and more of a creative say as to how it's done and even how long it or short it would be. So do you have a preference?
Yeah, I mean, 100% my preference would be, I feel I have a really good touch on my generation. So my preference would definitely be platforms that are geared towards an audience of my generation, which would be Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, even maybe HBO's, FX, something like that. Yeah, you know, I would prefer more creative freedom. But at the same time, having the ability to work on a storied network like NBC or ABC or, you know, something with a long history that's kind of been around since the beginning of television, you know, that would also be just quite the opportunity, you know, as someone who's grown up only kind of watching those channels still, you know, NBC, Seinfeld, and The Office and all these other great television shows. So, you know, while I would prefer definitely the freedom of a streaming platform, you know, there's pluses and minuses to both.
You mentioned your generation. We should let the audience know you're 23 years old, correct?
Yes, I am.
And being on a set is not necessarily foreign to you. You had worked on your father's commercial production sets as a PA and a grip when you were a teenager, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I mean, I actually started, my first set experience was around 10 years old. I actually had that conversation with my dad a couple weeks ago, trying to figure out when exactly it started. But yeah, you know, I'd been making films all throughout junior high with just friends and, you know, kind of the classic Spielberg type story or whatever, you know, just always making films, always doing stuff, making films throughout high school and working on set. So yeah, film has just sort of always been a big part of my life.
Hey, I was that kid too, so I know exactly what you're talking about. Now, so even though you had been on sets before, like your dad's sets in the past, was it a different world, a different situation when you, you know, were serious about this particular project? You went out and got a loan. You shot the pilot. Was it a different experience? Was there anything during this experience that perhaps you weren't prepared for or didn't expect or thought was different than how it was going to turn out?
Yeah, you know, definitely stepping in as a director on set and also being the producer at the same time, it's pretty clear that, you know, once I'm on set, there's no one else to answer the questions for me. You know, I'm the person who's got to answer all the questions, and I've got to come up, you know, with all the solutions. So, you know, it's really fun. I actually really enjoy it. It's creative problem solving. It's what I love doing. And but, you know, when I kind of was first experiencing that on my first sets, maybe back 3 years ago when we were shooting really early versions of the pilot, it was definitely a little overwhelming. But, you know, it's been a learning experience, and there's no place I'm more confident now than on a set managing 50, 75 people. You know, we've had really big shoot days and stuff like that. And, you know, there's no experience like it.
Now, you shot the pilot, but I understand you already have the plot lines for several episodes beyond the pilot, correct?
Oh, yeah. I have actually 6 seasons of the show laid out and, yeah, plenty of episode concepts.
6 seasons of how many episodes per season?
Ideally, I laid it out as 10, you know, so about 60 episodes. But, I mean, as you know from working at a theater, it could almost go on forever. I mean, there's almost just endless amounts between you got the customers, between interactions between your employees, between, you know, the push from upper management. There's so much to do in a movie theater setting, I feel like, that, you know, even though I only have, you know, quote-unquote 60 episodes laid out, I do think that you could definitely make more if the audience wanted to see it.
Now, I touched on a little bit about what the show is about. As I said in the introduction, it centers around Ryan Wyatt, a budding filmmaker who was working as an usher at Royal Cinemas. But it's more than that. He, too, is a budding filmmaker, correct?
Yeah, you know, I decided to put a little autobiographical spin on it. You know, write what you know is definitely advice I was given early on and have kind of stuck to in not only this project, but some of my other projects. So, yeah, I figured kind of give the film, the main character, some of the same aspirations I had when I was working at a movie theater.
Has that been a bit of a cathartic process for you? I mean, here you are basically putting down on paper and then on the screen elements of what you had gone through. Does it give you a chance to reflect at the same time as you produce this show?
Oh, totally, totally. You know, I actually moved closer to the movie theater I worked at when I was working at a movie theater during high school. So almost every day I passed the place I worked. And it definitely was an interesting reflection on my time there. And, you know, I think it's made me almost cherish working there a little more than I might have if I didn't do this. It's left me with some fond memories and memories of characters. And that's kind of the thing I think anyone who maybe worked in a movie theater will tell you is that it ends up being about the people you work with, which is what keeps you there, because it's definitely not the job itself.
Yeah. Tell me, how can people see the pilot, and what is the situation now? What is the status of getting more done?
Well, you can see the pilot on thecastmembers.com. That's maybe the easiest way. It's also at the same time on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thecastmembers. Blue Vision Entertainment, we have a YouTube channel that the pilot's on. You know, it's at a variety of different places to watch. And we're kind of out right now, as you know, I'm working with a great publicity firm out in Santa Monica, Jonas Public Relations, and we're kind of helping build up the story and build up the name of the show, and then hopefully be able to get some, you know, managers or agents for myself involved, or maybe just go directly to some of these companies like Netflix or Hulu or a network, and hopefully try to get a deal done with the show to make some more episodes.
Well, the show is a lot of fun, so continued success. Hopefully it'll turn into something really big for you and the cast members of the cast members.
Right?
Thank you
so much.
Thank you very much, Aaron, for being on the program. Continued success with all you do.
Thank you, and have a happy new year.
Aaron David Roberts, the creator, producer, and director of the web series The Cast Members. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0438, and you'll find links to Aaron's website and where you can find the show. I urge you to check it out. It's well worth the look. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
A Long Island woman was busted after robbing a bank while her young daughter waited in the getaway car. Diana Marini passed a note demanding cash to a teller inside a Chase Bank branch. The 28-year-old woman grabbed an undisclosed amount of cash, ran out of the bank, and got into a waiting taxi. Responding cops found the cab nearby with Marini and her 6-year-old daughter inside. She was charged with robbery and endangering the welfare of a child. Her daughter was released to family members. You know, bank robbery isn't one of those professions that features take your daughter to work day. I mean, why, oh why, would you take a taxi to rob a bank and have them waiting outside for you? And who in this day and age would leave their 6-year-old child in the back seat of a cab driven by a complete stranger? Well, one kind of person and one kind of person only. An idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0438. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0438. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. If you were listening to this at the same time as watching The Wizard of Oz and listening to Pink Floyd's The Dark Side of the Moon, well, it's a waste of electricity. There's some things you just can't multitask.